You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Anthony Richter. I'm the Associate Director of the Open Society Foundations. We're very fortunate this evening to have with us Ahmed Rashid, the most prominent and best-informed Pakistani chronicler and analyst of Pakistan's military intelligence complex, and in particular in his latest book of the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. His new book, Pakistan on the Brink, is very timely. 2011 was a very hard year for Pakistan, and certainly in terms of U.S.-Pakistan relations, probably the worst ever. Everyone in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship seems to be bickering these days. The U.S. and Pakistani militaries are quarreling. The U.S. and Pakistani intelligence don't trust each other. The politicians have their hands full keeping things moving forward. Ahmed's turned in a superb job, all in very difficult circumstances, in what the Committee to Protect Journalists calls the most dangerous country in the world to be a journalist. To interview Ahmed about his book and to moderate this evening's event, we're also particularly privileged to have another expert author on Pakistan, Thomson Reuters' David Rode, who presented not long ago from this venue his and his wife's book, A Rope and a Prayer. So before handing over to our speakers, I just want to announce that and remind you that this evening's event is being recorded. So please bear that in mind when asking your questions. You'll have to queue up for the microphone during the Q&A. Over to you.
Great. Thank you, Anthony. It's a thrill and an honor here to be with my friend Ahmed. I covered Pakistan for the New York Times from 2002 to 2005 and kept coming back after that. And all Western journalists sort of looked at Ahmed as the sort of person you could go to try to understand what was happening there. And I want to emphasize his courage as a Pakistani journalist for saying what he thinks and, you know, in particular confronting the Pakistani military, which we'll talk more about tonight. And I also want to, you know, be honest about my own bias when it comes to Ahmed. Anthony mentioned a book I had written with my wife, which recounted my kidnapping by the Taliban now several years ago. During my 7 months in captivity, Ahmed was a tremendous source of sort of knowledge, support, and empathy for my wife, Kristen. So I like this guy a lot. You're free to ask any questions you want. He's on his own to answer the questions, but I want to be honest with you. I'm going to sort of do a Q&A with Ahmed for about 30 minutes, then we'll open up to questions. And I first want to ask you, Ahmed, it's easy, and there's lots of criticism in this country of Pakistan. My first question is, what are we doing wrong? What is the United States doing wrong now? What has the Obama administration done wrong in Afghanistan and Pakistan since they came in promising a new approach in 2009.
Well, thank you, Anthony, David. It's a great pleasure to be here. I launched my Taliban book here in 2000 when nobody had heard of the Taliban, and I think about eight people turned up. I remember very well. And but you know, then 9/11 happened and everything took off, and it's thank you all very much, and it's lovely to see so many Pakistani Indian students here. That is really nice. Thank you, David, for that. Those very warm words, and I have the same feelings of friendship and warmth towards you and your wife and baby, as always. I write, you know, quite, you know, I started off as a great fan of Obama, and I've supported almost all his initiatives. I think there have been two problems with Obama in dealing with Pakistan and Afghanistan, broadly speaking. No single policy in either country has been followed through consistently to the end. Whether it was the Kerry Lugar bill, aid to the civilians in Pakistan, whether it was the civilian surge in Afghanistan, or you know, dealing with President Karzai, that's been the first thing. The second thing is that the administration has been very badly divided. I think initially handing over the State Department to Secretary Hillary Clinton, she putting up one, you know, whole edifice there with AFPAC, of course, headed by Richard Holbrooke, and the White House was really not wanting to deal with them and really left them alone. So whatever Holbrooke was doing and whatever he wanted to do towards Pakistan and towards Afghanistan, it didn't meet with the kind of unqualified support it should have met with from the White House and the President. Now we're in this process of negotiations, you know, talks with the Taliban. The Americans are talking to the Taliban. The talks are suspended right now. But again, you know, there are divisions. The military, the U.S. military, is not particularly in favor of it. It's very hesitant and doubtful about it. Secretary of Defense Panetta has been sitting on this first confidence-building measure, the exchange of prisoners. This was supposed to happen 3-4 months ago. It hasn't happened yet. And there again, you know, you don't have the presidential stamp and support which should be given to the mediators in the State Department who are trying to mediate this very difficult and complex negotiation where you know, there is a lot of hostility from Afghans, from the northern, the non-Pashtuns, from women, from human rights groups in the West, etc. There is a lot of opposition to this. And if these negotiations are to go forward, obviously they should have the full support of President Karzai, which is also another question, but has been lacking. And they should have the support of the U.S. president. I think, you know, with Pakistan, I think generally people in Washington seem to have become Congress, the military, the CIA, even, you know, in the White House, there's enormous frustration with Pakistan. And I fear that if Pakistan, and the U.S. has a lot, I mean, we can go into the details of the last 1 year of mishandling. I'm not going to do that. But clearly, if Pakistan does not change its foreign policy and does not change its national security relationship with its neighbors and with the West, I see very much that the U.S. will humor Pakistan until 2014 and will then basically abandon Pakistan and will then take all the decisions that it wants to take with India without thinking that they have to balance it off by doing something with Pakistan. And that would be disastrous for Pakistan. Because Pakistan, whether we like it or not, remains dependent on Western banks, Western institutions. Democracy can only be strengthened with ties to the West. No other ally, certainly not China or anyone else, can play the role that the US and Europe play with Pakistan.
The response from Washington or many Americans would be that they don't have a partner in Pakistan. And we'll talk about the military in a minute. But you know, when I was there, this was before the PPP had come in. There was sort of hope that, you know, the problem under Musharraf had been sort of military rule and democracy was the answer in Pakistan. You go into this in great detail in the book, and the book is excellent, by the way. But can you talk about President Zardari and Gilani and their performance? And, you know, are you disappointed yourself? What's holding them back? Is the answer to bad democracy still more democracy?
It's been hugely disappointing, without a doubt. I think there was enormous expectation from Benazir Bhutto, and it was tragic and sad for the country, historically speaking, that she was assassinated. And, you know, Zardari was not even second or third best in the lineup. He was very low down the line. In fact, you know, Benazir was not intending to bring him back at all. Even if she had won the elections, she was going to keep him in Dubai looking after the children. And so, you know, we have a real, he became president, and unfortunately, the hopes of the government have more or less been dashed. He, first of all, sidelined most of the People's Party who had been loyal to Benazir during the Musharraf era, brought in his own group of people through which he has governed. He has been effective in some areas, to give him credit. He has, for example, given up a lot of his powers to the prime minister, as it should be. That was after quite a struggle, but he has done it. And he has talked about devolution, and he's trying to do devolution. But the key relationship has been with the army. And there has been this mixture of taking the army on, in a confrontation, as he tried to do when initially in the beginning when he tried to remove the ISI from the control of the army and move it to the Interior Ministry, or he's totally succumbed. And where I think, there, what was needed has been a policy of gradualism. The army, was in power for 10 years under Musharraf. It was not going to relinquish power all of a sudden. It had to be shown that civilian rule that was better, that the civilians were competent, they could perform, that the civilians were much preferred internationally, Pakistan would get aid and support for its programs, the civilians would be much better to carry out de-radicalization of the extremist groups that exist in Pakistan. But instead of creating a strategic dimension to his government in which, you could debate with the military as to the direction to take, whether it was Afghanistan, whether it was with India. There was either a complete surrender or there was a desire to somehow overnight, overthrow the government. I mean, this whole Memogate affair that has happened recently is another example of that. So as a consequence, the military actually in the last 4 years has become even more powerful. Certainly, the whole foreign policy direction is being dictated to the military. And what I say, is that we started making mistakes at the end of the Cold War. We never recognized that the end of the Cold War had brought about an immense change in global thinking. And the benefits of the end of the Cold War in the 90s completely passed Pakistan by. The military at that time wanted to support the Taliban in the 90s, if you remember, in completely isolating itself from the outside world. And whereas people were, doing globalization and new industries were coming up and high tech and all this, and third world exports were increasing and regional alliances were being made in Asia and Europe, ASEAN, EU were all being strengthened. We remained this power which was supporting one war in Afghanistan, supporting militants in Kashmir, and we completely, were left on the sidelines. And after, if the Cold War had not been a lesson, 9/11 was certainly a lesson, that you cannot run a foreign policy based on militant extremists. That era was now over. And, I don't think that lesson was learned. We did a U-turn. We backed the support, the attack on Afghanistan. But immediately that was over, all the Taliban, Al-Qaeda came into Pakistan, took up refuge in Pakistan. And in 2003, they were relaunched with the help of the military and the ISI to take on the Afghan government and the Americans. And that was a huge mistake. And I think there were several moments, in 2006, before the big Taliban offensive, when the Americans start recognizing the importance of this Taliban leftovers in Pakistan. And that was the time when we should have presented the Taliban and said, look, negotiate something with the Taliban, bring them into the mainstream. And instead, it was just the opposite. The Taliban were obliged, partly by Pakistan, partly by their own initiative, to intensify their offensive in Afghanistan. And that, created the present impasse.
That somewhat leads us to a person you know quite well in the region through these years, Hamid Karzai. You wrote about him here and then in a magazine story. If you could talk a bit about his perspective of the United States and how it's changed over the years. Again, we Americans like to sort of blame him. People, frankly, question his mental health. How does he see the U.S., and is there a more productive way to engage with him?
Well, there have been huge problems with Karzai, especially recently. Karzai has all along supported the idea of American talking to the Taliban. He supported this Qatar initiative. I mean, I have a chapter on the talking with the Taliban in this book. he quite accepted the fact that the Taliban initially wanted to talk to the Americans, because the Taliban saw the Americans as the occupiers and that they wanted to deal with the real power before they got on to talking to Karzai. And he accepted all that. And then when these talks finally sort of took root at Bonn at the end of last year, he did a U-turn and turned around and said, no, I have to be included immediately. And he almost scuppered the talks. I mean, you know, they were almost ditched because of his position. I think, you know, the problem with Karzai, but especially now, is the conflicting advice that he gets within his own presidency and the cabinet. There are people in the presidency who are ex-Gulbuddin Hikmatyar or ex-Taliban who are giving him, you know, don't trust the Americans, don't trust anyone, in fact, don't sign a deal with Pakistan, don't talk to the Taliban, don't, and there are others who are urging exactly the opposite. And Karzai, I think, because of his continued basic isolation, because of the security problems, he doesn't get out of the palace, he doesn't get to see ordinary people, he doesn't get to see very much of public opinion. He remains buffeted by these conflicting figures who are there. He has not been able to build a consistent, you know, all the best people who, if you look at Afghanistan, they've had some very competent ministers. I would say probably more competent than Pakistan has had under, with this government. The Afghans have had very competent ministers in the government. They've all been thrown out by Karzai because of one thing or the other. Kabul is full, and the presidency is full of conspiracy theories, you know, as to, and he believes most of them, unfortunately. And there is no real reality check. Now, but the other thing I will say about him is that he has also been buffeted by conflicting opinions given by the Americans. The military general will walk in and give him one opinion, how we're going to attack the Taliban, slaughter them all, and all the rest of it. You know, diplomats will come in and say, we want to talk to the Taliban. And again, as I said, this administration has not had a consistent policy. It has not been able to unite all the elements of government, which, you know, which should be united in dealing with the war. And all these opinions, Karzai is hearing all these opinions. And It's confusing to him. It's confusing, and it creates an enormous lack of trust. So I think, you know, it's a double blow, basically, the problems you know, that he faces. I think the immediate political task for him is to build a consensus in Afghanistan for talks with the Taliban. There is no consensus on this. As you may know, I mean, the non-Pashtuns are very much against it. Many Pashtuns are against it. Large sections of society, the new, if you like, urbanized Afghans who are who benefited from the last 10 years of the Western presence are also against it. And, you know, this is really his failing to realize that you can't enter into negotiations with the Taliban and treat it as a family affair. You know, I'll send one brother here and my younger brother will go there and they'll meet with the Taliban and everything will be resolved. This is not a family business, you know, that you're operating. This is a national, you know, it's a national task to bring this war to an end. And you have to have a negotiating team that is representative of all of Afghanistan, and you have to work politically to build a national consensus, and he hasn't done that. The Americans can't do that. There's enormous anti-Americanism right now in Afghanistan. There's a lack of trust of the Americans. The Afghans have to build a consensus for negotiations.
On that note, there is a great description of the negotiations here and the hopes, in a sense, that there are Taliban to negotiate with. A lot of people are skeptical about that. Particularly in sort of recent polling, Afghan women are very concerned that the Taliban have not changed and that they're basically engaging in these talks to wait the Americans out, wait until 2014, and they'll be just as brutal as they were before. And, you know, Tajiks and others say that this is essentially appeasing the Taliban. I mean, have the Taliban really changed?
Well, you know, I think their views from what they were have certainly become much more moderate. I think strategically now they want to see themselves or project themselves as less jihadist and more nationalist and more patriotic. That they're fighting the occupying forces, but they want to go home to Afghanistan from Pakistan and you know take part in the politics of the country. I think the second, I mean, and we've seen on the ground they've distanced themselves from Al Qaeda. They have categorically said they will never allow foreign extremist groups to take root in Afghanistan. Again, there has been a change of attitude towards girls, women's education, girls' education, etc. But you know, I think the key issue really with the Taliban is that these negotiations are being led by the older generation. That is the generation who were in power in the 90s. A lot of these, well, some of them certainly realize that they utterly failed in the 90s to govern the country. They know that they can't govern the country again. They know also very well that if they were to, you know, seize Kabul, they would basically divide the country. The North would never go with them. And they would certainly not be in a position to reconquer the North as they did in 98, 99, 2000. And the second part of this is that they also know that if they were to be left in power in Kabul alone, the whole world would abandon them once again. Nobody would have time to negotiate anything with the Taliban. And the economic aid, the money, the etc. Would be lost, and in 6 months the Afghan people would turn against them. Remember, in 2000, 2001, the Afghan people were fleeing Afghanistan because there was economic collapse, there was a drought, there was famine, and the Taliban were unable to do anything because nobody really wanted to help them. And so they don't want to repeat that situation. And it's much better for them that they go into partnership with someone who, like Karzai or whoever the next president is, who has an international face and can, you know, sustain levels of aid for the next few years to put Afghanistan on its feet.
And how, I mean, does this older leadership control the Taliban?
Well, you know? I mean... That's a very big test. I don't think anyone knows. I don't think even, you know, the ISI knows or the CIA knows. Now, that is precisely the phase that we're in, trying to build confidence between the Americans and the Taliban, and both need to test each other. The Taliban want to be sure that the Americans are serious about negotiations and that this is just not a ploy, you know, to keep everyone happy till 2014 or to try and, you know, reduce the Taliban. And likewise with the Americans, I mean, they have to be sure that, you know, if there's going to be confidence-building measures, these CBMs along the road, and obviously there have to be military CBMs between the militaries of the two sides, can the leadership deliver on its promises. So if Mullah Omar orders, you know, these landmines to stop or the killing of Afghan civilians and officials to stop, will the younger commanders obey him? I can't answer that question, but I think, despite everything, you know, one thing has been quite remarkable, that the Afghan Taliban have remained a very loyal, hierarchical force. Rogue commanders in the last 10 years have been killed off, either by the Americans or by, you know, literally by the Taliban leading rogue commanders into an ambush where, you know, they are killed. And the loyalty still to Mullah Omar and the leadership Shura, I think, is very strong. And it's a loyalty, you know, based on belief. It's a loyalty based on the whole tribal system of loyalty. It's a loyalty based on many things. Certainly, you know, if you look at the Taliban, they've been much more disciplined, much more hierarchically organized, and much more loyal to their leader than we've seen on the Afghan government side. And that is something that is of advantage when you're trying to negotiate with them. So now you may not need to negotiate with Mullah Omar. I think it would be a mistake to do so. But you certainly would need Mullah Omar's blessing at the end of the negotiation to guarantee that everyone will follow the results of that negotiation.
And can you write about this a bit, but how would the negotiation work? I mean, you talk about, right now there's this long delay, the talks about potentially releasing the five Taliban prisoners from Guantanamo. and moving into Qatar. But what would happen next? I mean, some people just question how this process could ever play out on the ground, that the government doesn't control its forces, and can the Taliban really control the other side?
Well, I mean, you know, my kind of idea, I have no idea which direction the Americans will go or the Taliban will go. But clearly there is an office, if there is, you know, this office is established in Qatar. First of all, you know, one would like to see Afghans coming to Qatar and meeting with the Taliban. Afghans of all persuasions, civil society, women, you know, the government, etc. It's not that these negotiations should just be monopolized by a couple of Americans and a couple of Karzai government people. The Taliban need to get exposure of what has happened in Afghanistan in the last 10 years. They don't have that exposure. Some of them do, who are retired and living in Kabul, but the real fighters who've been living in Pakistan don't have that exposure. And they need that exposure. They need to meet Afghan society and see the changes, you know, that have happened over the last 10 years. Now how these talks would progress, my bottom line simply in this book is that the Americans cannot withdraw from Afghanistan without ending the war. There has to be a U.S.-led negotiation with the Taliban and with the Afghan government that actually brings this war to an end. Now, you don't bring this war to an end by some grand deal or grand bargain. You do it step by step. You reduce the violence and the conflict step by step. So both sides have to give on certain things militarily to test each other, to build confidence, and to reduce the violence. So, for example, I mean, you can have one side say, okay, you stop doing this so-and-so, you stop killing so-and-so kind of people in one province for 1 month, and we'll do the same from the other side. And let's see how it works. And that's how you would build a kind of confidence between the two militaries, as it were. And then, obviously, there would have to be political negotiations with Karzai. Political negotiations about power sharing. What kind of power sharing? How would that be based? And then there would be an even more delicate negotiation, which would be about the future of the constitution and the future of Sharia law, which the Taliban, in fact, are still insisting that Sharia law has to apply, not the present constitution. So that would be another stage of the negotiations. So, you know, this is going to take a long time. It's not going to happen in weeks and months. It's going to happen possibly in years. And the Americans really need to get on with this if they think, you know, if they believe in this. The problem here is that a lot of Americans don't believe in this. And partly this is the fault of the administration for not doing enough salesmanship of what it wants. Neither the president nor the secretary of state have really put their sort of seal of approval and are really talking this up. Secondly, there's a real concern that with the elections going on here, that all this process could get stalled for the next 6-7 months because Obama's not going to take the risk of, you know, doing something dramatic with the Taliban and then having Romney or the Republicans, you know, come down hard on him for doing so. So I hope that we don't see a sort of stalled dialogue until November. I hope that, you know, the dialogue pushes ahead. And the third thing is, you know, that this administration, the next administration, has to build a consensus within the U.S., within the government, which is still not there. You know, there is still opposition to these talks within the government.
You mentioned women coming to Qatar and meeting with the Taliban, and you said that the Taliban have changed their position related to, I believe, education for girls. Can you talk about what specifically they've said and if it's really a serious change? The polls that I've seen, you know, show that some of the biggest fears are from women in the South, yeah, and, you know, that they will lose what they've, you know, gained in the last 10 years.
Well, I mean, you know, again, you know, the information is patchy, but basically for the last year and a half, it seems, the Taliban are not burning down girls' schools that they were for years and years. in large areas of the South and the East, they're not. And you've got Taliban now, these retired Taliban in Kabul, actually advocating education for girls and insisting that it's now not, it's not happening all over the country. And there are, you know, commanders who are obviously haven't got the message or are not doing it. But secondly, there does seem to be a general consensus that girls' education is being allowed. Now, what the Taliban attitude will be to working women, for example, you've got, you know, maybe 60, 70,000 Afghan women teachers, the same numbers in healthcare. You've got an explosion in education, which is really being led by women. Now, you know, we know what the Taliban attitudes were in the 90s. They were horrific. You know, now what I'm suggesting is that, you know, I don't think these attitudes are going to change because the Mullah Omar decrees it or something. They're going to change through the process of negotiations. You know, the Taliban need exposure to the outside world. They need to, you know, to listen to interlocutors. They need to listen to the Afghans. And the very process of negotiation, after all, has to be some kind of political compromise, military compromise, and social and economic compromise. Now, I'm not saying the Taliban are going to turn into, you know, good liberal Democrats overnight, not at all. But, you know, I think there is movement. I mean, just compare today the Afghan Taliban to the Pakistani Taliban. The Pakistani Taliban are burning girls' schools outside Peshawar today. It's not been stopped. Nothing has been stopped. At the moment, you know, many of the Pakistani Taliban's methods are far more brutal than, you know, even the Afghan Taliban. Of course, you know, so a major cause for, I think, you know, safety and security will be the Afghan Taliban attacks on civilians, especially the war of landmines. This clearly has to stop. But it will stop if, I think, there's some reciprocity from the other side, mm-hmm. you know, from the American side. It's not going to stop unilaterally.
And just my last question, of course, is about the ISI and the Pakistani military, and you're, you know, very critical of them in the book, and of course negotiations could be derailed by the ISI is what everyone argues. Is the ISI interested in negotiations? How do you include them? Do you exclude them? How do you deal with the ISI?
This is a very difficult question.
That's why it was the last question.
I don't think even the administration has been able to work this one out. No, I mean, first, let's, you know, I really do think that the military and the ISI, compared to their position a couple of years ago, really do believe now in an Afghan settlement, in negotiations, and in a sharing of power. I think the last thing the military wants in Pakistan is a Taliban government in Kabul, because they know perfectly well the problems that they had towards the end of the Taliban regime, how implacable the Taliban were to even Musharraf's demands that were being put on them in 2000 and 2001. So I think, you know, they want to support a negotiated end. I see Pakistan's position as wavering between two, one, a maximalist position, what I call a maximalist position, which is essentially, you know, no India in Afghanistan, we must be at the table throughout these negotiations. We should dictate the terms of who becomes governor in the provinces bordering Pakistan, that kind of micromanagement. And then there's a minimalist position, which is that, you know, we should compromise with India in activity in Afghanistan. We don't want to macromanage the situation. There should be an adequate sharing of power. We should just, you know, not have the most extreme Northern Alliance elements who Pakistan considers as anti-Pakistan come into power. And the military has essentially vacillated between these two positions, depending on where they're, you know, where their talks with the Americans are or where their talks with Karzai is. I think right now, given the enormous crisis in Pakistan at every level, economic, social, political, you know, the neighboring countries, the crisis with the United States, I think there is a kind of minimalist position. Now, will this last? Will it be sustained? And what role does Pakistan want to play in this dialogue between the Taliban and the Americans? Now, let's remember that this dialogue, which has been brokered by the Germans and Qatar, in a sense, bypassed the ISI. It bypassed Pakistan and created a lot of anger in Islamabad. You know, when this was disclosed that there's, you know, the Americans, I mean, what the ISI ideal position was that, you know, the Americans should come to us and they should ask us, you know, please, you know, help us find Taliban interlocutors to talk to. And of course, you have to be there to help us discover them. And actually, the Americans do the opposite. They go round the Pakistan military and discover the interlocutors without the help of Pakistan. So now bringing Pakistan into the fold, I think, is going to need quite a long, hefty negotiation between the Americans and Pakistan. I mean, one thing is they have to resolve many of these, you know, the breaking of the relationship and how this relationship is going to be restored. But I think certainly one plank which hopefully should bring Pakistan and the U.S. together, will be how to move forward with the Taliban. What role Pakistan, will Pakistan be helpful? Will it play a positive role? Will it not insist on trying to micromanage the situation, which the Taliban, by the way, are totally fed up with? I mean, one reason the Taliban really want a peace effort also is because they want to get out of the shadow of Pakistan. They, you know, all their language, even, you know, with the Americans, with the Qataris and others, is that they are also fed up with the micromanagement of Pakistan. So, you know, I don't think there's an easy answer to this. We have to see how the U.S.-Pakistan dialogue continues. But, you know, there is a common agenda here. The Americans and the Pakistanis can work on a common agenda to negotiate an end to this war.
Great. I want to open it up to questions now. You know, if you could make sure you ask questions and not present arguments, I would appreciate it. We're very lucky to have Ahmed here, and it's obviously a very complex but important topic. Sure. Great. That's great.
Those of us who were here, we heard about the issue surrounding the opium trade, and I thought maybe that might be something that would be relevant to discuss at this point.
Well, you know, I'm extremely worried about a potential collapse of the Afghan economy, whatever it is. You know, 150,000 troops are going to leave, or 100,000. Tens of thousands of Afghan work for the foreign troops. They're all going to be, and it's, if you like, the cream of these Afghans are represent the cream of what has of the proportion of Afghans who have benefited from the last 10 years. They're going to be rendered jobless. Is there an economy that can sustain them and provide them some sustenance? No, there isn't. And you know, frankly, the West, the neighboring countries, we've all failed to build a self-sustaining Afghan economy. And I fear very much that this withdrawal is going to create a huge economic crisis. And one result of this is going to be that the gains made in eliminating poppy from so many provinces in northern and western and eastern Afghanistan, the gains made are going to be lost. Because farmers are going to stop receiving the subsidies that they receive for not growing poppy, growing other crops, and the kind of support that they've received from NATO, the UN, the Americans, etc. That's going to disappear, and poppy, there's every chance that you may get an explosion of poppy. Now, again, if there's a political settlement with the Taliban, the Taliban are in a position to certainly enforce any expansion of major poppy trade. But the Taliban can't do it without economic alternatives. You know, we saw the Taliban in 2000 when they banned poppy, and it was banned nationwide for 1 year. They used pretty horrendous methods to affect that ban, but nevertheless, it was very effective. And if there is power sharing in these provinces, and you get Taliban officials actually trying to administer these provinces effectively with the help of the central government, you could get the lack. But I fear that, you know, poppy is going to make a comeback because of the economic crisis.
Recently, the Pakistani Chief Justice, Chaudhry, has revisited charges against Zardari and threatened to remove the prime minister, and then again revisited charges against the ISI. Is there a new power center here that could destabilize the current balance of power in the country, or is this a front for the military, or how do you see this initiative by the courts?
Well, I think there's no doubt there is a new power center. I mean, the judiciary has become much more assertive since the struggle against Musharraf by the lawyers, since the struggle to reinstate Chaudhry, who was sacked by Musharraf, in fact, and was then reinstated, something that President Zardari was not willing to do initially and was then forced to do because of demonstrations by the opposition and lawyers, etc. Depending on which side you're on, the ruling party, the People's Party, is pretty convinced that the judiciary is towing the line of the military. The military want to oust Zardari and Gilani before the elections, and the judiciary is playing along with them and trying to create problems for the government. There's no doubt that the judiciary has created immense problems for the government, paralyzed the government virtually for more than a year now. Both the president and the prime minister have been wrapped up in all sorts of cases which have sort of, sucked everyone dry of initiative and trying to do governance and other issues. And that kind of attitude by the judiciary, I think, has been very negative. It has interfered in the executive in an unprecedented way. Now, others will tell you, no, the judiciary is being very fair balanced. Look, it's bringing the ISI to court for these disappearances. But it's done that only recently after there was a lot of criticism against the judiciary that it was totally one-sided in its dislike of the present government. And at the other element, don't forget there's a kind of personal feud element also. The fact that Zardari and Chaudhry don't like each other at all. They've never got on with each other, and there have been political differences there. This is the problem, that it's the, Pakistan's leadership, whichever, part of the leadership structure you look at, are really tied up in the past. They are not looking to the future. These are not leaders who can develop a vision for the future. Whether you look at the civilian government or the military or the judiciary, unfortunately, this entire leadership is wrapped up with the past. And I think, young people are very frustrated with this, which is why we've got the phenomenon of Imran Khan and all this happening. But there's no real leader in the country who is trying to present a new narrative to young people, who's trying to explain the mistakes that were made, not because of conspiracies by the Indo-Zionist Jewish American lobby, but because of mistakes made by Pakistani leaders themselves. And no leaders will admit that, we have made mistakes, neither the military nor the politicians. And this is what I think is needed. We need a more self-critical attitude.
Good evening. So I have actually two questions. One is related to Mr. Karzai's recent attitudes regarding to the United States, where he harshly says that they don't want America anymore in Afghanistan, and they are really able to fight with Taliban. So how can you comment on this, and how can we see the very new future of Mr. Karzai's office and himself as a president? And the second question is much more related to Taliban's attitude in the Taliban's state in Afghanistan. In terms of, you have mentioned that Taliban has changed their attitude from being jihadist to more nationalist. And this is really very important thing, because it's changed the whole ideology. It's changed the whole thing fought for this huge period of time. So can we say that this changing which is happening is really a change, or they just want to seem to be changed in order to come to the power? Thank you.
You're absolutely right about Karzai, but the point is he's also, while he makes such comments, you know, I want nothing more to do with the United States, you all go home, I mean, you know, leave me alone here kind of thing, he's also trying to sign a strategic compact with the United States, which would involve, you know, 20,000 U.S. troops staying for 5-10 years more in bases in Afghanistan. So, you know, I mean, there is this contradictory thing. Now, on the strategic compact, there are huge divisions within, you know, within Karzai's own people, within the presidency and within the cabinet. But, you know, he considers it vital that before the NATO summit in Chicago in May, this compact is signed. He's just as keen as the Americans are that this compact is signed. Maybe this such a compact will be signed and then disappear because, you know, look what happened in Iraq. You wanted to leave 20,000 troops behind in Iraq, and the Iraqi government at the last minute said, no, please all go. We don't want anyone here. Maybe that will happen in Afghanistan too. But for the time being, I think these, you know, the killing of these 16 civilians was obviously horrendous, and Karzai reacts very emotionally to these kinds of events. The Quran burning equally so when Afghans were killed in the streets demonstrating, etc. But you know, he still wants to sign this agreement with the U.S. Whether this will be possible, we've just had more deaths now of NATO soldiers who were killed by Afghans in uniform. Whether U.S. troops will be able to stay on for another 5 years, I think, is you know, many people, I think, see this as being impossible and not practical at all. All the more reason, in my opinion, rather than, you know, going ahead with the strategic compact is you know, pushing full steam ahead with the negotiations with the Taliban and seeing what can come out of that.
And her second question was, have the Taliban really changed? Did this shift to a nationalist force, not a jihadist movement?
You know, I'm a great believer in negotiations. I mean, I was a witness to the Geneva Accords that brought about the Soviet withdrawal. I spent months and months with the negotiators in Geneva and, you know, all around the world. I was also, you know, very much connected with the Bonn Agreement in 2001. Look, I mean, the process, I mean, I can give you details of, you know, where people started in the Geneva negotiation, where the Russians started and where they ended up, you know, and where Pakistan, which was negotiating with the Afghan government, started and where Pakistan ended up. So I'm, you know, the process of negotiations, I think, mellows all positions. And I think the very fact that you now do have two negotiating partners is is in itself a huge success after 10 years of war. I hope that this effort will not be squandered. The Russians desperately wanted a negotiated, they wanted to negotiate with the Mujahideen at the end of the war so that there could be a power-sharing agreement between the Afghan communists and the Mujahideen. The CIA refused to do it. And the ISI refused to do it. I'm talking about 1989. You know, I hope we don't repeat that again, that, you know, institutions within the government, be it American or Pakistani, refuse to go along with a negotiated end.
Hello, my name is Shoaib Jalani. I just had a question. Doesn't increasing fragmentation and radicalization within the army and intelligence make it problematic to assign them unified agency? It seems the increasing fragmentation makes it really difficult to even hold it. It seems like a cop-out, but it's hard to hold the army accountable because it does seem that there's a lot of increasing radicalization within the army, and it's hard for...
Sorry, what are you talking about? Pakistan
in
or
Afghanistan?
Afghanistan
or Pakistan? Army. In Pakistan.
So there's...
Holding what together?
There's increasing fragmentation within the Pakistani army, it seems. Right. Increasing radicalization. Yeah. New generation, they're more religious, they're more fragmented, the hierarchy is being weakened in many ways. So is it problematic, you feel, to assign them unified agency, the army, to consider it one cohesive unit still?
Well, you know, I mean, that is something that, you know, I try and tackle, that, you know, the high command is under enormous pressure, especially on this anti-Americanism and the, you know, all these issues that have cropped up over the past year in relations with the U.S. The high command is under enormous pressure from mid-level and senior officers. There's no doubt. And radicalization, there are several cases, court-martials that are being held at the moment. But still, I mean, the army remains hierarchical, very disciplined, and united. And obviously, General Kiani faces a very difficult kind of balancing act. All the more reason why, you know, what I'm trying to say, that why we need to change direction of our national security agenda, particularly the agenda set by the military, that, you know, India is an enemy. In Afghanistan, we have to intervene all the time. And instead, have a national security agenda that is focused on rebuilding Pakistan and internalize, you know, yourself much more and try and, you know. I mean, I always say, you know, the geostrategic location of Pakistan surely should be, you know, is such a bonus for Pakistan. Yet we have never exploited it to the full. Here we are in the middle of huge land masses who want to connect with one another. Central Asia, and the Gulf, India and Iran, you know, and here we are promoting wars on all sides rather than promoting a consensus to build pipelines and trade and act as a land bridge. You know, I mean, Secretary Clinton talks about Afghanistan as a land bridge. Well, Pakistan is just as much a land bridge, except Pakistan even has access to the sea, which Afghanistan doesn't have. And yet for 60 years, we have refused to exploit this enormous potential. I mean, look at the energy crisis, you know, and look at the attempts since the 1990s to build pipelines across Pakistan. But how can you build pipelines if you're supporting the Taliban to wage war in Afghanistan? If you're not recognizing, if you're allowing the Baloch insurgency to spread and to increase because of the actions that are being taken by the military in Balochistan, and you treat the Baloch as Indian agents, you don't consider that the Baloch have real grievances, which they do. I mean, the Baloch have had 5 insurgencies in Pakistan against the Pakistan military. Clearly, something must be wrong there, you know. Nobody has an insurgency 5 times in 60 years. The failure to recognize, you know, the fact that, you know, you have to settle. I mean, who can build a pipeline across Pakistan? Because, you know, half of Pakistan is Balochistan. You know, and, you know, look at the mineral and the oil and gas wealth in Balochistan, which you're not able to exploit because, you know, you consider the Baloch as enemy, almost. So this kind of thinking is, you know, has to change. It has to change from within the military. I don't think, you know, the civilians are in a powerful position enough to change it. And I don't see in the near term we are going to have civilian leaders who are going to be able to change it. We need enlightened leadership in the military. We need military leadership that has a vision for the future of Pakistan, that not a vision where constantly we are using extremists to fight our wars for us, whether it's in Kashmir or whether it's in Afghanistan or in Tajikistan.
Hi. On this question of whether or not 150,000 foreign troops are leaving Afghanistan or not, I was on Camp Leatherneck about a year ago, and at the time, they were laying down paved
and
roads.
I'm not hearing, sorry. Can you talk a bit clearer?
Yeah, I was asking about this idea that 150,000 troops may or may not be leaving Afghanistan. I was on Camp Leatherneck in Helmand about a year ago, and at the time they were laying down paved roads and building water purification plants and building very large housing complexes. And unless that was all a going away present for Karzai, it looked very much like there was the intention of a significant residual presence. So how would that square with the demand that the Islamic Emirate has always made that foreign forces leave Afghanistan? And if I can squeeze in a second question, if it was possible, why would it be a bad idea to negotiate directly with Mullah Omar?
In answer to your second, you are negotiating directly with Mullah Omar. You're negotiating with his representative, somebody who's acted as his secretary and is extremely close to him, and certainly does not take any step without conferring with Mullah Omar. Mullah Omar is a very reclusive figure. I mean, he's not a public figure. You know, the very few people have met with him or dealt with him in the realm of negotiations. So I think, you know, it's better he has more articulate people who can actually go into negotiations with a sort of modern sense of what negotiating means, rather than a very simple, semi-literate tribal leader who really wouldn't know properly how to negotiate. Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, one reason why, you know, the American bases may not last beyond 2014 is because the Taliban will insist that, you know, we don't want any presence of foreign troops. But, you know, as I said earlier, I think there are many other reasons why the Americans may not stay. All the regional countries are against a prolonged American presence beyond 2014, except perhaps India. Certainly Pakistan, Iran, China, the Central Asians, Russia, they're all against a prolonged American presence beyond 2014. And they will have increasing clout in what happens. You know, I don't think Karzai can afford to, if all these regional countries come out very strongly against a strategic compact, I don't think Karzai can afford to antagonize all his neighbors just to keep, you know, 20,000 American troops in Afghanistan. And likewise, the conditions are deteriorating so fast between Afghans and the Americans, between the Afghan army, which the Americans have built at enormous cost and in the last 3 or 4 years, but contradictions between the Afghan army and the American army are increasing. So there are many reasons why perhaps this compact at the end of the day will not work. On the other hand, if negotiations progress well, the Taliban accept this presence that, you know, trainers are needed, et cetera, you know, then it could happen.
Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Javed. I'm from Afghanistan, and I work with the Open Society Foundations. You mentioned that the Taliban are different today, that they are good with women or better with women, education, and they're open to reform. So what makes you believe that? And what if it's a display, this display of tolerance is a trick to win over the population while the United States is totally losing over the overwinning hearts and minds of Afghans? And if we do not want to take any risks with the Taliban, because we don't want to be fooled twice, is it too late for the United States to start from the scratch? For example, by firstly, like you said, reduce the violence and then talk to Afghans, listen to Afghans, bring more money if the United States can afford to really start a real construction effort in Afghanistan like the US did in Europe. And from there, try to win over the Taliban politically by bring legitimacy to the Afghan government and remove the increasing legitimacy with the Taliban. Thank you.
Well, the second part of your question, I would say nobody's prepared for that at all. I think the Americans have demonstrated in both Iraq and Afghanistan that they are not the ideal nation builders. Unfortunately, the American system does not have the capacity to do nation building as it should be. I wish it did, but it doesn't. And there's been enormous wastage of money and all the rest of it. And certainly, given the economic recession, given the public opinion polls at home in Europe and in the United States, nobody is ready for a renewed. People want to get out as fast as they can. The Europeans want to get out even faster than the Americans. 80% of, generally speaking, European public is opposed to their forces being in Afghanistan. So, you know, we're left with very poor and very bad choices. I mean, I don't want to go on about, I'm sure, you know, the record of people in OSI are much better informed about the women's situation than I am. But, I will just say that, you know, I don't think the Taliban are in a ploy, that this whole negotiation is a ploy. I think they want to go home. You know, they're fed up with living in Pakistan. Many of their people have been arrested, they've been harassed, you know. I think a lot of them want to go home. Even I think the Haqqanis want to go home. And I think that's a perfectly legitimate desire and wish after 10 years of war, and if you count it all, 32 years of war. I think Afghans are tired and fed up. And I think we should take them seriously, take them at their word, and I think Afghan society should, you know, give these negotiations a chance. Because look, what is the first need for Afghanistan? It is security and bringing this war to an end. Everything else is secondary, everything else. The economy, jobs, education, the role for women, everything else is secondary to bringing the death and destruction in Afghanistan to an end. Now, I'm not saying you should sacrifice everything to do that, but I am saying that we have to focus on this primarily. After 10 years, you know, the two big enemies are talking to one another. Let's focus on trying to move towards some kind of understanding on reducing the conflict and the violence and bringing this war to an end. I think if that is feasible and possible between the Americans, Karzai, and the Taliban, then I think everything else can be negotiated. And, you know, as I said, I think we have to be patient and we have to see and understand and believe in the process of negotiation, changing people's attitudes. Maybe the Americans decide at the end of these negotiations not to keep 20,000 troops in Afghanistan. You know, think of that happening. Think of the Americans saying, well, we trust the Taliban. They're not going to allow Al-Qaeda back. They're not going to allow Pakistani Taliban and Lashkar-e-Tayyiba and all to take up root in Afghanistan. You know, you may have a walk back, not just from the Taliban, but a walk back from the Americans even.
And if I can just ask a follow-up, what if the talks fail? I mean, what should be the fallback position? Because it's an extremely weak negotiating position for the United States to be in, that they have to reach an agreement. The Taliban can sort of dictate their terms. You know, what is an alternative? If the Taliban refuse to compromise, does the U.S. stay?
I think the fallback position is what we saw. You know, Afghan history repeats itself again and again and again. I mean, the fallback position is Najibullah's position in 1989, which is Fortress Kabul. You know, the Americans secure Fortress Kabul. And you secure a few other cities, you know, around the country. Certainly the north will be secure because the Taliban will not have a presence there. But then you're virtually, you know, talking about, God forbid, you know, division of the country. Because the Taliban will move into the south in large numbers. There will be a continued state of conflict. There will be no investment. All these big deals for minerals and oil exploration and all, et cetera, will, you know, fall away by the wayside. There is no B, you know, plan B except more conflict, war, bloodshed, and a prolonged American presence in the region, which will, frankly, only increase and lead to more anti-Americanism in the entire region.
Sorry, go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Timo Muller. I'm a student in international affairs at the New School. I want to stay on the topic of negotiations, the reconciliation process. Yesterday, the International Crisis Group published a report, you might have read it, that is extremely critical of the current reconciliation negotiation attempts. It called the international community's approach to negotiations a bizarre approach, accusing the International Crisis Group of basically negotiating with everyone that comes to the table, watering down own commitments. And it proposes or it calls upon the Security General, UN Secretary General, excuse myself, to step in and use his good offices. I have two questions in this regard. What do you think of where do you see the role of the United Nations? And what criteria do you wish to attach to the current negotiation attempts if you, I assume, see problems with the current approach to negotiations?
You know, a role for a UN mediator, which is essentially what you're asking, it was discussed initially by the Obama administration when they came in, and when these, you know, when the first overtures were made by the Taliban for talks with Richard Holbrooke. Now, it was debated, and it was decided that no, we Americans will negotiate ourselves. which was, you know, a bit of a funny position because, you know, you are one of the parties to the war, but you also want to negotiate the peace. Now, you know, this issue with all that has happened in the last few weeks and months in Afghanistan, the killing of these civilians, the Quran burning, etc. Again, I think this issue of whether the United Nations should appoint a negotiator or not has risen within the U.S. administration. It is, you know, again, it's something that is being talked about, at least on the sides, if not by the principals. I believe that initially, if the Obama administration had gone for a UN a negotiator, it would have been beneficial. But I think there are two or three problems. The first thing is that, I mean, quite frankly, the UN under this present regime of Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has really disappointed far too many people. The UN's clout has been reduced enormously compared to the time of Kofi Annan. The UN has not undertaken major negotiations or of any kind, under this present regime. And, I think there's an enormous loss of faith, which, by the way, was enormous in Afghanistan for the UN, because the UN stuck it through in Afghanistan years and years, you know, when everybody else had left, with Taliban, etc., the UN stuck it out. Many Afghans would still prefer the UN, but I think the UN has lost enormous prestige in the region as a whole, because the UN would need partners. It would need Pakistan, Iran, the regional countries, etc. So I think one problem is having the UN, is the state of the UN. You know, I personally am extremely disappointed in the leadership of the United Nations right now. It has shown no initiative in this part of the world whatsoever. And frankly, you know, if this continues, we are going to see the major demise of, you know, the demise of a major international organization. So, is the UN in a position, you know, to take this on right now? I don't think so, frankly. I don't think so. Can a mediator emerge from the? I think it's more likely that a mediator can emerge from the global community rather. You know, I don't see any major American mediator who could step in right now and be a real force for peace and convince the world that this is happening, convince the Taliban. It's more likely that such a mediator exists outside the United States than inside the United States. But I think it's probably too late now, you know, for the UN. And I don't see the Americans really, this administration, agreeing to it. And I certainly don't see a new administration agreeing to it. Let me just say, I think a lot of this fault lies with the UN itself.
And all right. I think the other question about the ICG report was, are there certain bottom lines that should exist in these negotiations that the international community shouldn't be talking to certain people? There are certain demands the Taliban must meet.
No, these negotiations, when the Taliban approached Richard Holbrooke initially, these negotiations were based on unconditional talks. And this means that the Americans say, we want a statement from you absolutely, categorically denouncing Al-Qaeda and saying Al-Qaeda is terrible and all. You know, I don't see negotiations moving forward if these conditions are going to be put in. And, the Taliban are very clear about this. You know, we are not going to give preconditions. We're not asking them from you either. You know, the American, because of this division in the administration, you've got parts of the administration inserting conditions into these talks. And that's been one of the delays of these talks moving forward. Frankly, I don't believe that negotiations between two sides who've been at war for 10 years can start off with preconditions. Look, as these negotiations progress, the Taliban negotiators are going to be sabotaged and attacked and assassinated. God forbid, but so possibly, you know, both sides are going to face immense Al-Qaeda, all sorts of elements, extremists in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in the region as a whole. There are all sorts of people who are going to try and make this effort fail. And the killing of Professor Rabbani in September was certainly a very strong indicator of that. We don't know who killed him, but whoever it was clearly set back the talks for 3 months. You know, it was a very effective killing because it created so much mistrust and doubt in the minds of Karzai, in the minds of Pakistan, the Taliban, all the leading players. So, God forbid, I mean, these negotiations are risky enough as it is without having these this idea of preconditions. You know, it may be very, I go back to the fact of, you know, having sat in on two negotiations in Afghanistan. Both those negotiations really didn't start with preconditions. As a question of principle, you know, I agree. It's very sad. I mean, obviously, I would like to see a precondition that the Taliban respect women or that the Taliban, you know, stop using bombs against civilians. Or that they should denounce Al-Qaeda, you know. But then the Americans are not prepared to offer preconditions either. So let's not get into this game. I think, you know, these negotiations will end with, I think, the conditions that we would like to see.
Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
Hi, my name is Rahman Azhar, and I've been working as a journalist in Pakistan for some years. My question is, there has been some talk about political instability and the kind of leaders Pakistan has. Can military take over in Pakistan again? And if so, will it help the cause of Pakistan-US relations and negotiations? Because apparently, military regimes has sort of a love affair with United States.
For the time being, I don't see the military taking over in Pakistan. I think the military is far too weak, politically speaking. There are far too many people now, including people not, you know, parts of, you know, the general public who are opposed to military rule. They see that how military rule has brought Pakistan into these cul-de-sacs in which, you know, the whole political process is stymied and delayed by years and years. I think a bad democracy is still better than military rule. We may have a succession of bad democracies, of bad governments in Pakistan, but ultimately I think they will still be preferable to military rule. Military rule does not have an exit strategy. It never can has an exit strategy. It can only lead to more demonstrations, and finally they're booted out by popular unrest or by some other catastrophic event. You know, military rule cannot lead. It's a whole idea that military will come in and clean the system and do away with corruption, and then they will hand over to the civilians. We've had that four times in Pakistan. We know perfectly well that, you know, nobody hands over power to the civilians. Nobody hands over power to the Democrats. Nobody cleans up the system even. The military, you know, the military in power becomes even more corrupt than the military out of power. So I think the solution is that these, I hope that these elections, which are scheduled for next year, they should be brought forward to end this whole political unrest and everything that is happening. I hope that by the end of the year, elections can take place, that there will be a transition. If this government loses the election, fine. Let, you know, whoever wins the election come into power. It'll probably be a new coalition government. I don't think anybody will win the elections outright. And let people develop some faith in a political system and in democracy. Oh, look, the real tragedy of Pakistan's political parties has been that nobody's joined these political parties. You know, we are dealing with a leadership that is 20, 30 years old. You know, why do we have these dynastic leaders? You know, how many people, for example, in the 10 years of Musharraf actually joined the People's Party? I'm talking about, you know, technocrats, educated people who could give the party some dynamic movement, strategy, etc. I can probably count them on one hand. The same goes for Nawaz Sharif. Nobody joins politics under military rule. There's no reason to, because you know there is no politics. The leaders are in exile. The parties are banned. The press is not there, etc. So we need to restore faith in the political system so that young people who are totally averse to politics, joining the politics, who are averse to service. You know, after all, government is meant to be service. You know, I mean, this is the big criteria in America and in all other countries. You join the civil service, you join the government because there's some idealism there that you believe in. There's no such idealism for Pakistanis who, differ from joining the government. So, you know, I hope that we don't see any kind of military takeover.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Devanand Ramaya. Thank you very much for your analysis and presentation. My question is on the assassination of Professor Rabbani. You touched upon it. Even though you mentioned that you don't know who killed him, in the sense of whether it is related to the Afghan peace and reintegration program, and was his assassination in some sense linked to the negotiation process, or some people argue that it's to do with wiping away of a second-tier leadership that can take over post-2014. We'd be interested to hear your analysis on that. Thank you.
Look, I'll just repeat what I said. I have no idea, who killed him. But whoever did it wanted to stall or delay or sabotage the peace process. And they succeeded for a time. Not entirely, but they did succeed for a time. And that is the warning that we should take into the months ahead, that these talks have to be protected in all manner of speaking.
Go ahead.
Hi, Shahzad Ghazi, Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. Could you please talk a little bit more about the complex relationship between the ISI and the Taliban, going from the ISI harassing both the Taliban and their families, and the Taliban sort of getting rid of, at times, or assassinating non-Taliban Pakhtun leaders who the Pakistani military and the ISI like to keep an alliance with? So if you could go over the dynamics of that complex relationship between the proxy and the state sponsor, I guess. Thanks.
Well, most of what you ask is in my earlier book, Descent into Chaos, about the revival of the Taliban movement in Pakistan in 2003, and I touch upon it in this book also. I think the ISI and the military failed to draw the lessons that were very apparent to, people like us who were going into Afghanistan in 2000. Pakistan had very little control over the Taliban government once bin Laden moved to Afghanistan. And even the sort of minimalist demands that the military regime were placing on the Taliban, just to restore some kind of economic aid and all the rest of it, they refused. And Pakistan up till then was aiding, it was providing money, it was providing weapons, it was providing hundreds of soldiers to man their tanks and their heavy guns in the war against the Northern Alliance. It was micromanaging the situation. And the military, of course, denied, but it's undeniable. This happened. And unfortunately, after 9/11, and certainly in 2003 and subsequently, we don't seem to have learned, those lessons. We ourselves, lecture the Americans that Afghans are Afghans. Afghans are very fierce, and Afghans are very independent-minded, and Afghans are stubborn, and Afghans are this and that, and don't think that the Afghans will do what you want. Only we understand the Afghans. Well, we have ignored our own lectures to the Americans and to the Soviets and all the rest of it. We still, unfortunately, and this term arose in the 1990s, we tend to treat Afghanistan as a fifth province of Pakistan, that somehow this is a fifth province, and that Afghans should be dictated to. And we run Afghanistan. We can micromanage Afghanistan. Well, that's nonsense. First of all, Pakistan today is the most disliked country in Afghanistan. And when I say that, in Pakistan, people are horrified. And people say, you're lying, and we've done so much for the Afghans. I said today, because Pakistan is seen as one of the actors in sustaining this war, it is intensely disliked by all Afghans of all persuasions. And what I'm trying to say right now is even the Taliban. One reason they're negotiating with the Americans is precisely this. So, I don't want to get into the details now, but I think that, the same, do the Taliban control, do the ISI control the Taliban? I would say absolutely not. The fact that the Taliban bypassed the ISI and went and negotiated, found negotiations with the Americans, speaks volumes as to what the Taliban's political position is vis-a-vis Pakistan. Now, we should learn from this. Now, we can sit and abuse the Taliban, the damn Taliban. You know, we've given them hospitality, we've fed them, we've armed them, and you know, here they go around us and they go behind our backs and they go and talk to the Americans, which is, by the way, what the attitude is, unfortunately, in Islamabad. What I'm saying is something completely different, that learn from this. You know, change your strategy and tactics. The Taliban, you know, don't want you as an interlocutor for them. They want to negotiate on their own. Thanks.
I want, if you can both ask your questions, it's 7 o'clock and we should end soon, but I want to let both of you
Hi, my name is Sarah. I'm a student at Columbia University. So you spoke at length about negotiations with the Afghan Taliban. I wondered if you could share your thoughts on the potential for and the ideal structure of negotiations with the Pakistani Taliban. Who would be legitimate mediators for such negotiation? And how would the present state of civil-military relationship in Pakistan bear upon such negotiations?
And then just the last question, if you could go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Shyam. And quick question, it's a little different. Can you comment on the situation for journalists right now, from what happened to Mr. Rode to the saddening outcomes of Danny Pearl and Salim Shahzad? How bad is it? And is there any hope for getting some good on-the-ground information these days?
I'm going to make you take one more question and then...
Hi, my name is Sadia. I work at a financial consultancy in the city. My question was just in the beginning, you mentioned that the U.S. should help Pakistan out of all the issues that it's developed and put in right now. But don't you feel that time and time again, we've been disappointed by how we've been actually brought into situations and then taken out of it by the U.S. and it's more time for us to let go of their aid and actually develop from within, rather than depending on all the things that are happening the same way time and time again in society?
Okay, so first, talks with the Pakistani Taliban.
Look, you know, the Pakistani Taliban are divided between what the military considers as good Taliban, in other words, those who don't attack the military but go and attack the Americans and the Afghans inside Afghanistan, and the bad Taliban who... Pakistani Taliban, who attack the military and lay all these bombs and suicide, you know. And there's been, for the last 4 or 5 years, there's been a, in my opinion, a devastatingly poor attempt to play divide and rule amongst the Pakistani Taliban. And this has clearly not worked. And there's no way you can continue this. I feel that you cannot really deal with the Pakistani Taliban unless the Afghan Taliban first come into some kind of negotiated end. Look, the raison d'etre for the Pakistani Taliban, the sort of ideological raison d'etre, is that we are supporting our brothers in Afghanistan who are fighting the jihad against foreign occupation. And we are fighting the Pakistan Army because we are the Pakistan Army is the stooge of the Americans. Now, if the Afghan Taliban were to suddenly end the conflict, you know, share power with Karzai, et cetera, et cetera, you know, and there was a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Afghanistan, I think it would have a devastating blow for all these militant groups in Pakistan. You know, not just the Pakistani Taliban, but all the groups, Lashkar-e-Taiba, all these groups who have been fighting in Kashmir and in other places. Now, the question is, what do we do with the consequences of a peace settlement in Afghanistan? Do we continue keeping these extremists as a tool for Pakistan's foreign policy? Or do we actually develop a vision and a strategy to de-radicalize these people? And that's what is really critical to me, you know. As I said earlier to you, I mean, you know, this whole era of keeping extremists as a kind of foreign policy front against India, against Afghanistan, this is over. This was over in 1989. It's certainly over after 2001. So what we should be doing is preparing the ground. And this, of course, goes to the heart of for the military and the ISI, preparing the ground for a widespread de-radicalization once peace can be established in Afghanistan. I don't think we can tackle the issue of the Pakistani Taliban in isolation from the need for the Americans to withdraw from Afghanistan and the need for a peaceful settlement in Afghanistan.
Journalists.
But look, on journalists, I will just say, I think people here are, I'm sure well informed about the problems. Certainly, many journalists have suffered from threats over the decades from the extremists, whether they were Afghan extremists or Pakistani extremists. I think the new addition is that, in the last couple of years, the threat has also come from the state, and particularly from the intelligence agencies. I think the real fear of the press is that there doesn't seem to be any red lines left. There were red lines that the intelligence agencies respected, and there were red lines that the press respected. In how you deal with the military, write about the military, portray the military, etc. And from that side, there was a certain red line that no harm should come to the journalists. There can be pressure, there can be, intimidation, there can be harassment, there can be bribery, there can be all sorts of things, but no direct physical harm. Now, those red lines seem to have been broken from the other side. I hope that, red lines can be reestablished. Unfortunately, the civilian government has played no role whatsoever in defending the press. And all these committees, like CPJ and other community Reporters Without Borders and all these groups who've gone out to try and talk to the government have really met with no support. So those journalists who are victimized are really left with very little internal support from elements of the state. Either the government is too scared to help the journalists, and other elements of the state are just not helpful. So it's been a very difficult time for the press in Pakistan.
And the last question was, wouldn't Pakistan be better off without the Americans?
Look, just look at what's happened in the last 5 months since this breakdown. Nobody talks to us, right? The Europeans, all the aid of the European Union, everybody has slowed down. They haven't stopped, but everybody has slowed down their aid. The reluctance of the World Bank or the IMF to get into any kind of dialogue. Unfortunately, we are not Iran or North Korea, thank God. We are not either, China or even India, which has a growth rates of 8 or 9% and don't really need foreign help. Whether we like it or not, I wish we could be dependent on ourselves economically, politically, and I hope that day will come. But certainly we are not at the moment. We are going to need enormous support. But that support is not going to come from the international community until we change our foreign policy and we go in for economic reform, both of which we are refusing to do. Both the government and the military is refusing to do. It's an unsustainable position that Pakistan is in right now. There's been heavy rioting in Punjab because, people are facing 18 hours of no electricity a day. And now the summer is upon us, very soon. And the heat and industries come to... I don't want to go into the whole sort of litany of the plight of Pakistan right now. But certainly relations with the U.S., is considered by the international community, for a country like Pakistan, as vital if the international community is to collaborate with Pakistan, whether it's aid or development or projects or budgetary support or whatever. So, we do need a relationship with the U.S. Yes, down the road, if you want to go into, let's go into a self-sustaining mood where we develop the economy, we internalize our problems, we look at ourselves, we build ourselves up, we develop a growth rate of 8 or 9%, and then we say to the Americans, goodbye. Yes, that's fine. But right now, I don't see that happening.
Thank you so much. It's a tremendous book. I thank you for all your work over so many decades in the region. I think we all hope that there can be less suffering by average Afghans and Pakistanis. They are paying the greatest price, as always, unfortunately. Thank you again, and thank everyone for coming.
Thank you very much.